Please start the tape over there. My name is Peter Nash, and this is the second of two sessions on what we call the succession narrative, or the story of the succession to the throne of David, although the story starts in the middle of his reign, and how power was abused, in these two stories, how power was abused and neglected, and what the consequences were, and during the reign of David, so that maybe we can be a little more conscious of the power that we do have. I don't think there are any kings, crown princes, queens, or princesses in the room, but we do all have a certain, at least modicum of power and authority in our lives, and we can maybe be a little more conscious of how we wield that power. And maybe we'll be a little less willing to abdicate it when we see what can happen when power is abdicated. We're going to look this evening at some very unpleasant stories. One in particular is the rape of Tamar, one of David's daughters. And the other one is the rape of Dinah, just tangentially. But in the rape of Tamar, we'll take a look at how the story unfolds, what the king is not paying attention to. And then once it's brought to his attention, what he doesn't do, how in fact the crown prince abused his power in the absence of the use of power by the king. Have I got this written up here? Neglect of power which allowed the rape, the abuse of power which was the rape, the neglect of power which allowed then the abuse of another prince's power, which was to take revenge on the crown prince, followed by yet another abuse of power in a revolt of one of the princes, the man who was then second in line to the throne, Absalom. But what this means is we're going to have to read a lot of the story tonight, so we need to get started. And it starts at the beginning of 2 Samuel 13. So if you'll turn there with me, does everyone have Bibles? Anyone else, anyone, besides me? Second Samuel 13. This picks up on the heels. Let me just say another thing about this. Yesterday morning we talked some about the David and Bathsheba incident. And I want to point out two things from the carryover here. One is that although these stories deal with what we classify in the modern West as sexual crimes, and they certainly were considered sexual crimes or crimes against women, I don't think this long story is at all about David's proclivities and his son's proclivities or desires for women. I think they're stories about men who had power and didn't control it. That was the one thing. Oh, the second thing is that that power is a divine gift, and it is given for the preservation of the covenant people. If we don't use it that way, then what we're doing is blaspheming. What we're doing is taking something given to us for a specific purpose from God and twisting the creation. If someone's there in 13 verse 1, go ahead and start reading. I'm fairly certain that everybody hasn't read this story since confirmation.
Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar, and after a time Amnon, David's son, loved her, and Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shemaiah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. And he said to him, "O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me? Amnon said to him, I love Tamar, my brother, Absalom's sister. Jonadab said to him, lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat, and prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat it from her hand. So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, pray that my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight, that I may eat from her hand. And David sent home Tamar, saying, go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him. So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, where he was lying down. And she took dough and kneaded it and made cake in his sight and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, send out everyone from me. So everyone went out from him. And Amnon said to Tamar, bring the food into the chamber that I may eat from your hand. And Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, come lie with me, my sister. She answered him, no, my brother, do not force me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this wanton folly. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the wanton fools in Israel. Now therefore I pray, speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. But he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her.
Thanks. Now, again, this is Amnon. This is David's firstborn back from at Hebron, at least according to the Book of Chronicles, when it lists the king's sons. Amnon is listed as the first. So we assume, and although we shouldn't assume anything, we're going to go ahead anyway here, that this is the one who's in line for the throne. His cousin addresses him, O son of the king, which seems to have significance here. If you believe what I said yesterday and what I said at the beginning of the hour today, what is the responsibility of the prince? What is the responsibility of the king?
Order and preservation of the covenant.
Order and preservation of the covenant. And what is how does Tamar remind him of this? What does she say to him?
She's saying,
that such a thing is not done in Israel. This is against the law. We're maybe not even talking about rape here against the law, but the law of brother and sister, half brother, half sister, incest is the case. It's kind of fuzzy which she is saying is not done. You know, for us it's very clear, but in this text it's kind of fuzzy because we have the precedent. Although they didn't exactly use precedent law, they used if-then law, apodictic law, where they laid out some situations similar to case law, but not quite. Of Abraham and Sarah, in the stories that are now called the matriarch in distress, where Abraham looked and saw himself apparently about to be killed and said, no, this is my sister. And in the E tradition in Genesis, they didn't like the fact that the patriarch was a liar. They didn't seem to mind the fact that he sold his wife off to save his hide, but they didn't like the fact that the patriarch was a liar. And in Genesis 20, the story comes along and tells us that she was, in fact, his half-sister. So there's a possibility of half-sisters and brothers, but the laws of Deuteronomy and Leviticus make it quite clear that this sort of relationship is not supposed to be consummated in marriage. But she says, ask the king. You don't have to do this. If you really want me, if you really love me, that's great. The king will make it happen. But that's not what he's concerned about. He has worked himself into a frenzy so much that he is really becoming sick. And the text says that he loved her with kind of a burning love, according to the idiom in the Hebrew, which turns, as we'll see in a moment, to a burning hate as soon as the act is finished. But she reminds him of his task, his appointed task. He's the guy who's being prepared in an apprenticeship as crown prince to make sure that there is justice in the land, to make sure that the weak are protected. The story takes pains to tell us that she's a virgin. She's of that age where she's supposed to be protected by the father's household. So even in the family line, she's even if he weren't the crown prince, it would still be his obligation to protect her. But he's in double trouble here, and she's pointed that out to him. He just ignores it. Questions or comments about the story so far? Someone else pick up and read along for us? It's a bit further.
Then Amnon hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Arise, be gone." But she said to him, "No, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other which you did to me." But he would not listen to her. He called the young man who served him and said, "Put this woman out of my presence and hold the door after her." Now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king clad of old. So this servant put her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and rent the long robe which she wore. And she laid her hand on her head and went away, crying aloud as she went.
That's far enough. We'll pick up with the next piece in just a minute. So what's his action? We're clear about this. He, at the beginning of the story, how many verses is this? Not even 20 verses. And sometimes when the Hebrew writers want to give us a story in a hurry, they really pack it pretty tightly, and it's kind of nice. But at the beginning of the story, he loves her with a love that makes him sick. At the end of this episode, where are we? Hates her. Throws her out, literally. Well, not even literally. He doesn't even throw her out. He has the servant come in and throw her out. The servants whom he sent away so there would be no witnesses in the first part of this episode, has them come back in and throw her out and hold the door behind her. Make sure that she doesn't get back in. She has already, in the first part of that we read, reminded him that such a thing is not done in Israel. And what are her words to him when he tells her to get up and leave? This is even worse than what you've already done. We made a mistake. You've made a mistake. Don't compound it. Don't compound the mistake by this. You tell me, is this a problem with sexual behavior? Or is this a problem with abuse of a human being?
Abuse of a human being,
and doing so, why? Because he has power. Because he can. Now, why is this all happening? Who sent Tamar there in the first place? The king. King doesn't seem to have a clue as to what's going on in his own household. So, in my opinion, David's neglected power here, and. This is a woman who's off in a separate house because it's the custom. Now you can quibble with the customs of the ancient Near East and the Israelite world if you want to, but this was their way of keeping her safe. One of this word betulah, virgin, as it's translated here, is still used in modern day, at least Egyptian Arabic, betul for boys and betulah for girls. Which means that they're separated, is that they're from one another, for some obvious reasons and some other cultural reasons, and that's why, one of the reasons why we say it means virgin, because if you don't have contact, you don't have opportunity, then you're quite likely to stay a virgin. So the king has taken her from that safe situation and put her into this situation where Amnon is in complete control. Now, there's no indication that he has a reason to worry about him, but does it seem prudent? What do you think? It does seem prudent?
Well, if that's the way their customs of separation, and yet he puts him in a situation that he's not separated.
Where? I would think so. I mean, this guy knows what goes on when men and women get together, right? He's been through the ringer once himself. At least once himself, by this point. So David neglects his power, leaves a vacuum in which someone who is not ready to take power, the crown prince, has complete authority, and he abuses it. He sends everybody away so there are no witnesses. He rapes his half-sister and then throws her out the door. Right. What follows, well, not quite immediately, but very soon in the next part of this episode where Absalom comes to play. Let's pick up there and see what happens once this happens. Someone else pick up the story here.
And her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart." So Tamar dwelt a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. After 2 full years, Absalom...
Okay, hang on a second. Well, what did David do? He got very angry. Hey, yeah, the story doesn't even tell us what he was angry about. But it certainly doesn't indicate that there's any action here from David. I need to ask us to move, put your finger in the Bible and move back to Genesis 34. We'll see a similar story with a different twist. Someone pick up here. Genesis 34:1.
Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young woman as a wife." And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the fields, so Jacob held his peace until they came.
Okay, hold on just a second. What does Jacob do? He holds his peace. And what's Absalom's advice to Tamar? Hold your peace. Same word, same phrase in English, same word in Hebrew. But in the Genesis story, it's because his sons are out with the flocks. He doesn't have any power to take any action at this point. He's one old guy, a sojourner in the Canaanite land, and a Canaanite has violated his daughter. He holds his peace because his sons are out. Now his sons come back and they take wretched vengeance. I don't want to read through all of the story, so I'll just summarize it. They come back, they find out what's happened to their sister. They're enraged and embarrassed. And so the conversation goes on about the marriage, and they say, "Well, we can't marry uncircumcised into an uncircumcised clan. All the men of Shechem and Hamor's clan are circumcised." And while they're lying around suffering from their wounds, the sons of Jacob go in and slaughter that clan. That's the vengeance that they take for this rape. All right. This is Genesis, so we don't have the laws yet that tell you what to do when someone rapes your sister or your daughter. But it does, as we shall now see, set a precedent. Because what Absalom is about to do exceeds the law, but not the custom that we see here in Genesis 34. Someone pick up here with after 2 years, I think it's where we are.
After 2 full years, Absalom had sheep shearers at Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold, your servant has sheep shearers. Pray, let the king and his servants go with your servant." But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go, lest we be burdensome to you." He pressed him, but he would not go, but gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If not, pray let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom pressed him until he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Then Absalom commanded his servants, "Mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, 'Strike Amnon,' then kill him. Fear not, have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. And all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. While they were on the way, tidings came to David, "Absalom has slain all the king's sons, and not one of them is left." Then the king arose and rent his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants who were standing by rent their garments.
Okay. The king doesn't show up at this party, allows his sons to go out, and this is the opportunity, another one of these power vacuums. Now, I'm not going to suggest that the king or the president should be everywhere all the time, but it is another one of these power vacuums, and we don't know. You know, Absalom, we don't know what Absalom had in mind at this point. He may have wanted revenge against his father, because just a couple chapters we'll see he's almost successful with a coup against the king, his father. But David isn't there. He's not in charge of the situation. And after 2 years of not speaking, apparently of not speaking evil or good, you know, just not speaking, not saying, "You jerk," and not saying, "Hey, how you doing, brother?" He invites him, you know, make sure this one is at the party. He gives the instructions, when he's drunk, you kill him, to his own servants. And don't worry, after all, I'm the king's son, and I'm giving you the instructions. I'll let you decide whether or not this is an abuse of power. I think it is, because it does exceed the law here, what happens in this sort of a situation. Whether he's avenging this or taking revenge, or whether he's just clearing the way for himself. Amnon is number two, number one in line for the throne. Absalom is number three in line for the throne. So every time we tick somebody off in this story, we get a chance to look at, well, who might be the king? And we'll see a description in a few moments of Absalom being very princely indeed in the way he looks and the way he takes care of his hair. So this neglect of power, this power vacuum created by someone who has power, not exercising it, again, in this case, David, leads to this abuse, which is the murder of, and you figure it out, because there's no clear-cut answer whether this is revenge, avenging the sister, or making the way clear. But it is an abuse. It is an abuse. So we've gotten one brother out of the way. We've avenged / taken revenge on the sister. But where is the sister in all this? And remember back to what the text said about her? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of this power wielding going on here and positioning and posturing has done absolutely nothing for Tamar. I doubt that she said, "Yippee, he's dead!" She didn't come out of her shamed state. She had no place to take her shame except for to her brother's house, as she said. And he made the space for her. it accomplished nothing. Probably to just make us aware, remind us of what's going on in the world today, on the other side of the world. Probably like this coup that's going on in the Soviet Union right now. I don't think anybody's got any more potatoes today than they had yesterday. And I doubt that they will have any more in 6 months. But power is being shifted around and people are posturing for power here. And I don't think taking care of it very well, but we can talk, and maybe we'll try to make time to talk about how one should use power. Where did we leave off here? 31. Oh, and now what's David's reaction?
He was angry.
He was angry? He rent his garments. When was the last time we saw, well, you don't know, the last time we saw David rent his garment was his son born of Bathsheba died.
Severe sorrow, grief.
Same thing that Tamar did when she was raped and thrown out. She tore off this virgin's robe and turned it into a mourning robe and poured ashes upon her head. David was angry about Tamar being raped in his household by his crown prince, but now he's mourning the death of his sons. It's really only one. The report came back exaggerated. He really had a thing here, apparently, for Amnon. As he will develop for Absalom too, but for his boys, he seems to have a real soft spot. For the girl, he seems not to really exercise the power that he's supposed to exercise to protect her, to make sure that the one without a voice in this culture has a voice and is safe. Let's go ahead here. There's enough here that everybody can have a chance to read if you want.
Starting in 32, while they were on the way, tidings came to David, Absalom has slain all the king's sons, and not one of them is left. Then the king arose and rent his garments, and lay on the earth, and all his servants who were standing by rent their garments. But Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, said, let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon alone is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he forced his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king so take it to heart as to suppose that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon alone is dead.
Okay. Go a little farther, please.
But Absalom fled, and the young man who kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked. And behold, many people were coming from the Horonaim road by the side of the mountain. And Jonadab said to the king, behold, the king's sons have come. As your servant said, so it has come about. And as soon as he had finished speaking, behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept. And the king also and all his servants wept very bitterly.
Okay, and let's finish, not quite finish off Absalom here, but go through 37.
But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son day after day.
Okay. Thanks. So the story is exaggerated here. And who is it that gives David the word of comfort or a word of direction as to where his anger should be? The word for me is mixture. I don't think this guy is saying, oh, don't worry, king, all your sons aren't dead. I think he's...
It's the same one, Jonadab.
Jonadab, the smart nephew of the king.
Yeah, he's the one who connived to get Tamar to Amnon.
Yeah, and he's the one who connived to get Tamar into Amnon's clutches, and he's the one who knows why Amnon is dead and knows who's done it. And I think it looks like a word of comfort if you read it quickly, but I think it's putting the finger on Absalom, yes, and this is the one. Right. Someone else pick up.
Geshur, and was there 3 years, And the spirit of the king longed to go forth to Absalom, for he was comforted about Amnon, seeing he was dead.
Okay, so he finally comes to terms with it, and he wants to deal with him. Go a little further, will you?
Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart went out to Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and fetched from there a wise woman, and said to her, pretend to be a mourner, and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. And go to the king, and speak thus to him. So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground, and did obeisance, and said, help, O king. And the king said to her, what is your trouble? She answered, alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead, and your handmaid had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to part them, and one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole family has risen against your handmaid, and they say, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may kill him for the life of his brother whom he slew. And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal which is left, and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant upon the face of the earth.
Okay. I'm going to skip through here real quickly. Does this remind you of anything? Does her story remind you of anything? Okay, Nathan's parable. David's going to have the same kind of response. And you got to love David, right? Because, again, when he's confronted with his guilt, hard-headedness, whatever you want to call it in this case, guilt certainly in the first case, hard-headedness in this case, he comes around immediately and repents. And we're going to see Absalom come back into the royal household, although in a somewhat removed state. He's not going to come with the words that David speaks to him are rather cool, as the story puts it. And he's not going to be right back in the center of things. And that in itself is going to cause a problem. So let's skip from there to the beginning of 15. So what time is it, John?
7:21.
Thanks. You want to pick up here? 15:1.
After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses, and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a suit to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? And when he said, your service is the sections of the tribe of Israel, Absalom would say to him, see, your claims are good and right, but there is no man deputed by the king to hear you. Absalom said moreover, oh, that I were judge in the land, and every man with a suit or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice. And whenever a man came near to do obedience to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel.
Who stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Now it's not clear here, the story doesn't make it clear. And this is shaky. We don't know who to believe here. All we have is the story that says Absalom was able to convince people that they couldn't get justice from the king. So I'm going to walk out on some thin ice here and say there's another vacuum of power here. Justice is not being proclaimed in the land. And Absalom has stepped in to make his own frontier justice, so to speak. I'm going to make that statement. I'm going to back right up off the ice and say, I can't prove that from the story. All right? it may just be that Absalom is simply setting himself up to usurp the throne. As I said before, he's number three. I don't remember who is in front of him in line for the throne. He's already taken care of one and made his way back into the royal household, although somewhat at a distance. And now he's gone out and put on princely trappings. He's got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. That's pretty darn impressive in the ancient Near East. Okay? And he's there acting like the king, stretching out his hand, kissing the man, saying, boy, I wish I were the shofate, the judge, translated as judge, but actually, what role did the judges play in the book of Judges? Did they sit at court and pass out justice? Only in a couple cases do we see that, although we know that was part of their role. Deborah was one. But what was their big role in the book of Judges?
Ruler.
King, basically. Temporary king. To provide military leadership and to make sure that there was peace, tranquility, safety throughout the land. Gosh, I wish I were able to do that. Yeah. Like Jimmy Carter back in, what was that, 74, walking around shaking people's hands, handing out cards, hi, I'm Jimmy Carter running for president, or Ronald Reagan, and then 78, 79, 80, saying, God, I want to be the one to do this. Yeah. Absalom's running for king here. Okay, after 4 years of this, what happens? Someone pick up for me in 7?
When 4 years had gone by, Absalom said to the king, allow me to go to Hebron and fulfill the vow which I have made to Yahweh. For when I was in Geshur and Aram, your servant made his vow. If Yahweh brings me back to Jerusalem, I shall pay my devotions to Yahweh in Hebron. The king said to him, go in peace. So he set off and he went to Hebron. Absalom sent couriers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, when you hear the trumpet sound, you are to say, Absalom is king of Hebron. When Absalom and 200 men from Jerusalem, maybe miles or so, then they have been invited and have gone all in innocence, unaware of what was going on. Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor from Gilo, his town, and had with him while offering the sacrifices. The conspiracy grew in strength and Absalom's supporters grew in number.
Okay, so this guy's running for a king. He's got the Iowa and the New Hampshire primary taken care of.
Yeah.
What's significant about Hebron? This is where David first became king. This is where Absalom is born. You know, the first, I think, 7 sons of David were born in Hebron. So he goes back. There's a base of support. It also gives him a claim to tradition. David started in Hebron, was king in Hebron for 7 years. Then, after Saul's death, and then when he was able to unite the northern and southern kingdom, moved the capital to Jerusalem, where he would have sort of a royal city that would be able to hold the allegiance of both parts of the nation. Sort of like Washington, D.C., neither fish nor fowl, not quite north, not quite south. That's the kind of role that Jerusalem played for David. I had a point about David and Saul and the transfer of power. David did some similar things to take claim of the kingship, one of which was to marry one of Saul's daughters, to give him a legitimate claim to the line of the king. And Absalom already had it in his birth, but he goes back both for support and for the claim to tradition. We're just about to what might be the ultimate vacuum here. Let's go ahead with 13.
A messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the Israelites have gone after Absalom. Then David said to all his officials who were with him at Jerusalem, "Get up, let us flee, or there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Hurry, or he will soon overtake us and bring disaster down upon us, and attack the city with the edge of the sword." The king's officials said to the king, "Your servants are ready to do whatever our lord the king decides." So the king left, followed by all his household, except 10 concubines, whom he left behind to look after the house.
What a guy. Go ahead, just another couple of verses.
The king left, followed by all the people, and they stopped at the last house. All his officials passed by him, and all the Cherethites, and all the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king.
All right. Who is this guy? Is this the same guy who went out, went and volunteered to King Saul? King Saul gives him his armor. It doesn't fit. He says, "Oh, this won't work for me," and then goes out with a stone and a piece of leather to fight a giant from Philistia. It's his son. And he just packs up from the city that we have heard cannot be conquered, although David did conquer it. A well-defended, high walls, up a hill to get there, only a few ways in, and David knows where they are. And his little boy, now a grown man, of course, says, I want to be king now. And he says, okay. What an abdication is, I guess, exactly the right word. What an abdication of power. And he's about to lose another son because of it. Because he doesn't take any measures here, but just slips out. And it turns out that Joab is the one who really gets him out of this soup. Because David, even when the moment comes, David can't do it. This is a long story, and I want to just kind of sweep through it. What happens is the war goes on for a long time, and at a crucial point, David sort of comes to his senses and decides not to just run. Again, counseled by Joab. And when Absalom, with his beautiful, long, flowing hair, somehow on his ascent to the throne, gets caught on his donkey. You wonder where this donkey comes from in the Passion narrative. He gets gets his hair, long hair, caught in a tree. And then rather than being captured and taken prisoner again to the king, Joab gives orders for the son to be killed, for Absalom to be killed. David still doesn't show very much leadership. I mean, he's got all of these people who have been fighting for him against this revolt. And instead of saying, "We've won, good job, guys," he starts to cry and mourn for his son. And again, evidence that David is very, very attached to his sons. We have seen him not be a very good leader in his household, and now he's not a very good leader even of warriors, which was his claim to fame. Because nobody, I don't know how we would react if our president got us into a war. Let's just go back to the last war. If we had managed to eliminate our stated enemy in the Iraq crisis and battle and whatever we call it, if we had managed to kill Saddam Hussein, the only person with whom we had a quarrel, and then George Bush had gone to his funeral, I think the military would have been really ticked and demoralized. And that's basically what David's doing. And Joab calls him to account and says, "Hey, these guys risked their lives for you. They can't see you doing this. Get up and be the king. Take the throne again." And at this point, number three in line to the throne is out of the way. There are a couple of other interesting stories, but they're not such clear pictures of neglect and abuse of power in David's household and the royal household of Israel. So we won't deal with them. We wind up, I think, with son number 10 finally taking the throne. One of the sons actually born in Jerusalem. We get rid of all of the sons born in Hebron. We get a Jerusalem-born son in Solomon, who happens, to me, this is another mark that in the midst of all this stupidity in David's household and this vengeance and this bloodletting, there's continued grace from God. Solomon comes along to the throne, and Solomon is guess whose son? Yeah. That in spite of where this thing started, God managed to use it for good. Now the story tells us that Bathsheba had something to do with that. There was some behind-the-scenes politicking, but Solomon is the one who comes to the throne. Questions or comments? Yeah, 10 minutes left. Yeah, we've got about 10 minutes for discussion or questions. This is the stuff I wanted to get out on the table and just to show you what can happen with our ideal king when he doesn't use his power, when he stands back and lets things happen rather than taking leadership.
I think when you start reading some of the Psalms that David wrote, and even Absalom wrote and you understand what the political situation was and the family situation, and then you start reading the Psalms and you fit them into some of the events that go on, you can relate them to today's events.
Yeah.
Easier. Okay. Yeah. Family abuse.
Yeah. I want to say that the Psalms that there are attributed to David and to Solomon, modern scholarship today isn't quite so convinced that those superscriptions are legitimate assignments, but they certainly are in the vein and then for those very sorts of situations. And we can understand why they get attributed to those people, and they certainly are extremely useful. For those sorts of situations that we still have today.
What about creating me a clean heart? Wasn't that attributed to David?
It certainly is attributed to David. The problem with scholarship is it can't prove anything certain. Mm-hmm. But that certainly is one of the favorites that we all know that is attributed to David. Yes?
Should we take heart from this story that in today's world, when power is misused, that God may still be acting in ways that we can't perceive?
I think absolutely we should take heart in these stories on that level, not to the point that I think we should take heart in that, and we should be challenged by it. Take heart in the fact that even we will at some point flies. May you abuse our power or neglect our power, but that God will not neglect us, as in this story. I think, yes, we should take heart in that. I think we should also take heart in the fact that one of the things I wanted to do with taking a look at some of the David stories is that this guy is such an ideal for us. And he was the ideal king for Israel for some good reasons and some bad reasons. And I wanted to look at the human side of this person so that we don't despair and say, oh, if I were only like David. If I only had David's faith. I mean, what does this guy say? The hearts of the messenger comes, the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. Then David said to all the servants who were with him, arise, let us go and flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us and bring down evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword. This is the other side of the guy who went out and stood and challenged Goliath. So to say that, every day of our lives we're not going to be fighting Goliath with great courage. There are going to be days in our lives when we're just scared spitless, and it's going to turn out that some of the times we're scared spitless for no good reason. I mean, from our children, and that there is grace in that message as far as I'm concerned. Any other comments or questions about the story? If not, I want to flip it for just a couple of minutes and ask about where are the places that we have power and authority in our lives. One obvious one that I've mentioned in this story brings up is with children. What goes on in our household, how brothers and sisters treat one another, and how we treat our children. Very graphic image here from David's, the difference between the way David reacts to tragedy for his daughter as opposed to tragedy for his sons, to try to make sure that we treat our children with some equity. We can't treat our children the same way because they're different, they're individuals, but with some equity. Yes?
In the workplace, if you're an executive or a teacher or a manager.
Okay. We often get the feeling that at work we don't have any authority. And this, let me tell you how easily this happens, and I always have to confess something when I'm teaching, at least up here. I don't do it in the classroom. this is my eighth year teaching in a graduate seminary, and I teach at least one required course every year. And I don't know if I'd... And I was finishing my doctorate while I was doing this, and I'd somehow forgot the power that my professors had over me and pretended that I didn't have any power over my students. Which was a real joke. You know, when I go in to talk to my doctoral advisor, he's God. You know, he has my whole life in his hand. And then, at least in the required course, I have that sort of authority over my students. You don't pass this course, you come back and take it again, which means another $1,500, which means maybe another year that you have to be in school. It means that you're ordaining, your Board of Ordained Ministry in the United Methodist Church is going to look askance. Basic Bible, you failed? What happened here? You want to be a pastor? And I, for probably the first 4 or 5 years, refused to admit that that was the kind of power that the school had vested in me and that students had vested in me, and acted like I didn't have any power in their lives. And it made for all kinds of bad relationships. Not that they'd ever admit it, because I had this power that I wasn't admitting that I had.
We have power over our own selves, and many times we don't. We abdicate power to someone else.
Yeah, someone puts dessert in front of me. Gosh, I've got to eat it. Yeah. No matter what, you know, it doesn't make any difference that my grandmother lost a leg and her eyesight from diabetes, and my mother discovered that she had diabetes about 10 years ago. And so chances are, but I've, you know, it's only polite, you know, I've got to eat it. We pretend we don't have any power over ourselves, and we pretend that in the workplace we're kind of caught in the middle, that we don't have power over anybody else, that what we do doesn't make a difference in what else happens in the company or in the church. Yeah.
Or that we, in the workplace, that we don't believe that we have responsibility of doing our task, whatever our task is.
Can you say just a little more about that? About not having, believing we don't have responsibility?
Why not? That's tough. That we don't have the responsibility to see that we admitted, are self-initiating and complete our tasks.
Mm-hmm. So what I do doesn't, what I do doesn't really make any difference if this one's not as good as the right standard. It's, who's it going to hurt? It's not really going to make any difference. Therefore, abdicating any responsibility and power to make the world a little bit better by the product or the service that we render, and at the same time, not taking responsibility for ourselves, not exercising the power we have to praise God through our work.
Or taking credit for what we have done.
Or not taking credit for what we've done.
In other words, giving it to somebody else, say, well, I couldn't have done it if, but you may have done it.
Yeah.
Sometimes we take a risk in assuming the responsibility for something, maybe for some decisions, especially if you've been in management, a management area, which I have. You sometimes take a risk with your uppers by making certain kinds of decisions which may or may not allow you to keep your job.
Yeah.
Sometimes the decisions that we make as Christians in the work field go, opposite of what maybe the company or the department or whatever would prefer that we would do.
Yeah.
And by taking that risk, you know, we're laying ourselves open for criticism or whatever we stand on a decision. Sometimes you can swing them around.
Sometimes you can swing folk around. Sometimes it's not a matter of just doing it, although it is easy, sometimes easier to be forgiven than to get permission. But sometimes you really can sway the thing by saying, going to your boss and saying, I don't think this is a moral way to do business. And I don't think it's good for business to do it this way. And you might find that you have the power that you got into the business for in the first place. Yeah.
We often the power of vote. A lot of people that.
Yeah, what are the figures now about the president, national election, the president gets elected by about 27% of the eligible voters?
30%.
30%? Yeah. That winds up being a majority. That's what you need as a majority of the registered voters, the people who registered voters who happen to vote in that election. So about 30% of the people in this country can elect a president. That's an incredible power. You know, I slipped the Soviet Union stuff in to make us mindful. You know, this is a gift that we all have. I don't want to offend anybody, but very few of us had to fight. I mean, literally fight for this. And we have problems with that, fighting for that, right? But some people did, and we get it as a gift. And I don't know what your voting record is, but I have my. The woman who does secretarial work for our faculty has she's just over 40. She's never voted.
What's interesting is a lot of people that don't vote are the ones who complain about the politicians.
Well, yeah, and she complains because she feels absolutely powerless. She doesn't think it's going to change anything. Yeah, I'm out of time, aren't I?
7:45.
Oh, how about that? I'm better off without a watch. Thanks for your attention and your participation in this. I hope David gives you some grace and some encouragement at the same time.